This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Sean McDonough will be with us at 12:30. We'll talk Caps, Carolina with the lead hockey voice on ESPN and ABC, Sean McDonough at 12:30. Joining us right now, as he does every Friday in this spot, Ben Standig from The Athletic, at Ben Standig on X on Twitter. He's got a podcast called Last Man Standig, but you should read him on The Athletic. He's great, and he joins us right now. So before we get to some team talk, because I do have a couple of specific questions for you, you know the whole schedule, you know, bit that I've been doing for many years. So I've given my season opener and then another game during the course of the season. Is there anything that you've kind of wanted to see? Like, we just took calls for a while on whether or not fans want Washington to open at Philadelphia. Taking maybe your, you know, reporter slash, you know, columnist hat off for a moment, would you like to see the season opener at Philadelphia?
I mean, I think that would be fun. Sure. I mean, not only is it a division game, it's, you know, the Super Bowl champ gets, you know, right, that Thursday night marquee game to open the season. So that would, I would put Washington there. And, you know,
that's what we're talking about, the opening game. Yeah. Philadelphia is going to host that opening game. Yep.
Yeah. And we've talked, you know, over and over again in the last, you know, several weeks and months about just how many different ways this is just so shocking how Washington is being viewed and how they've risen over the Snyder era, you know, most recently getting the NFL draft. To have Washington on the premier game, the NFL opener against the Super Bowl champ, would be yet another testament to just how far things have changed here. So, yeah, I would be cool with that. I mean, you know, I know sometimes the NFL seems like they like to have a one-off matchup as opposed to a division game necessarily. But look, I think, you know, if you look at the NFC, I think obviously we all have there's some questions about will Washington regress, how is it going to go, tougher schedule, and so on and so on. But as it stands right now, I guess you could say maybe the healthy Lions would maybe still be perceived as ahead of Washington, and, you know, but it's not like they're not there. So sure, why not Washington in week one at Philly? I'd be down with that.
Yeah. I don't really, you know, have a strong preference one way or the other. I'm looking forward to seeing where all of these high profile games land, because there are so many opportunities for it. But that opening Thursday night game, you know, they haven't always leaned on the most attractive matchup. Last year they had it with the Ravens and Chiefs in the rematch of the AFC title game from the year before. But, you know, the thought about that Thursday night game is they're going to have a massive audience no matter who's playing in it. You know, the year before, Detroit opened at Arrowhead, and Detroit was not supposed to be, you know, a high-profile team. They kind of became that, you know, that particular season. And they won the game. But anyway, all right. There are a couple of things that I wrote down in advance of you coming on today, because I've talked about a couple of things this week, reports. There was a report the other day on ESPN.com, part of sort of the aftermath of the draft, that Trey Amos may have fallen a little bit beyond where he was projected. But, you know, we've talked so much about the draft. You know, players 7 through 70, it seemed like they were kind of interchangeable. But there was some discussion that teams had had learned of a back injury that he had had. Do you know anything about that? And as to whether or not, you know, it's the reason that he fell to 61?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't hear that, and I didn't hear anybody discussing that pre-draft. Say, well,
nobody
like,
did
with Will, right? With like, say, with Will Johnson, the Michigan corner, sliding right from being a potential top 15 pick out of the first round. Like, that was a pretty clear reason as to why that occurred. So, if there was something there, it seems like it must have been fairly minor or not a huge deal, because even in the aftermath, I mean, it's not like anybody came out and said, well, now I can tell you X, Y, or Z. I mean, I know the report from ESPN is sort of doing that, but that was even after the fact of after the fact. So, yeah, I don't know too much about that beyond what was there. And, you know, we're going to obviously be at rookie camp tomorrow, and it'll be our first chance to talk to Dan Quinn since the draft. So, you know, presumably this is something that could come up to ask a question and ask Trey Amos directly himself what he thinks. But I hadn't heard anything, and I don't get this. I mean, I don't get any sense that there's any issue there, but, you know, I mean, he did slip a little bit. I would also just add that, you know, the corners, you know, when I kept looking at the mock drafts and doing, you know, my own and thinking about it, it seemed to me like they could absolutely take a corner at 30 or at 29, sorry. But as I kept going through the process, I never could figure out, and it never sensed like one of these corners, whether it was Amos or Benjamin Morrison or the Florida State kid or some others, that like anybody was like pulled ahead into that spot. And then it played out that way where they kind of all slipped a little bit. Like, it's not like anybody went right. I mean, I don't think anybody went particularly high. So it feels like the group as a whole slipped. And I think there may be something to that. I feel like corners are one of the positions that, even though it's viewed as a bigger deal, I do kind of feel like teams are de-emphasizing it a little bit. Because the passing game is, it's everything is so slanted towards the offense that it almost, you know, you'd have to have Deion Sanders and Darryl Green out there to, it feels like, at times to make a difference. So I do think that might be a factor with corners, but the back injury specifically, I'm unaware.
Washington's rookie minicamp opens really tomorrow to the media. We'll hear Dan Quinn talk tomorrow. The weather today sort of pushed that back to tomorrow. You know, just going back to the draft real quickly, because I was off on Monday, so we haven't talked since last week. Have you learned anything about, you know, as an example, in the fourth round, was it possible that if one of those edges, four of them came off, I think in the six or seven picks before they picked Jalen Lane, that maybe one of them could have been picked, that, you know, at 61, was there another possibility had a player been on the board? Was there another possibility? We heard the Howie Roseman stuff, which was interesting, because Adam Peters admitted that there was a chance to trade back, multiple chances to trade back, including hardly at all, and that may have been Philadelphia, who was at 32 in the moment. Just any sort of intel, you know, here now coming up on essentially 2 weeks after the draft.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that edge rusher was certainly something they were looking at, but, you know, ultimately, you know, as we discussed pre-draft, they had needs, and yet simultaneously were kind of covered everywhere should the board fall a certain way. And it would have been one thing if they had taken sort of like a position where you're like, really, why are you taking that over, you know, in the second or fourth round when you have sort of a clear need at an edge? So, but they didn't do that, right? I mean, they absolutely need more speed on offense.
Sure.
Not to mention in the return game. So taking a guy like Lane, you know, just makes a ton of sense. Now, sure, could they have, like you said, there was a lot of those edge guys that went off the board right before them or right around that pick, and could that have changed things? You know, maybe, but again, like, here's the thing. As much as we all talked about Edge, and I'm not saying it's not an issue, but it is concerning that they didn't do this. And this will certainly be a question, again, to bring up to Dan Quinn tomorrow when we talk to him. But, like, the way I look at it, like, the Connerly, the pick, the idea of an offensive tackle, I think that's going to be – that's something that has a chance to be a greater impact than potentially an edge guy at that spot in terms of, like, an offensive tackle is going to start every play. An edge guy is going to rotate. And I don't – you know, I don't think they had to force it. There were guys you could get later. Second round, they absolutely had to get – and by the way, in the division that they're in, Micah Parsons, the Giants have Brian Burns – Kayvon Thibodeau, and they were about to draft Abdul Carter, right? The Eagles, we know the depth that they have along the line. So it's an obvious something you need right off the bat there. In terms of the corners, same thing in the division, right? CeeDee Lamb, Neighbors, the Eagles have A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith. Obviously now Dallas even has George Pickens. So, like, they absolutely needed that. That was a clear – if they hadn't drafted a cornerback, let's just say, I think that would have been like a position we'd all be going, what are they doing here? Right, I mean, you know, you can get exposed, as we know, at that spot, and they didn't have anybody, or they didn't have enough. I would say, I would make an argument for. And then again, with that speed, if they don't add a guy like Lane with his profile, sure, they added Deebo Samuel, and I'm a believer that you can find receivers, but that type of playmaking ability, that speed, that is something they just did not have. So I think like all those spots were, again, maybe it's all on us. Maybe we just over discussed the edge rusher scenario. It is still the most glaring omission of this roster that they don't have anybody young, you know, highly athletic relative to NFL players. I mean, at that spot, and that's in a very important position. But they also were 30th against the run last year, and they clearly made a choice to go after guys that could help that. Javon Kinlaw will play some on the edge. Dietrich Wise is a better two-way player, whereas like Dante Fowler was much more of a just pure pass rusher type. So I think they made I think they did address the position, but they addressed it in terms of the run defense more than they did the pass rush. And, you know, to that end, it's not like they ignored it. It's just the way we're looking at it. They didn't get that guy. So, sure, I think if the board had gone a different way, maybe they would have done it. But I on some level, again, I'm not trying to backtrack off of, you know, I thought they would take an edge somewhere too, but they really needed these other things as much or more for this year's roster. Long term, you got to get an edge. But for this year, I think you can make an argument that these other positions were more glaring than edge when you factor in the run defense part.
How much, just one more on kind of the draft, how much do you think it is what maybe you just described, where the board just didn't fall the way it would have needed to fall for them to take a defensive edge? Or is part of it that we are underrating or not discussing enough the possibility that they really like what they have?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I mean, they obviously went out and signed these players. Like, look, let's be real. None of us know what Jacob Martin's all about, right? I don't know. I mean, I've read as much as everybody else has. I've looked at some of the tape. Who knows? Do they
want to tell everybody who that is?
Oh, sure. I'm one of their free agents that they signed. He had three sacks last year. He's the guy that maybe is the most, you're most hopeful can give them that spark off the edge. But look, you know, he's been a guy that's been in the league, hasn't done a ton. But look, they think, hey, with our system, with what we want to do, we can utilize him in ways that's going to free him up, especially if we get better play out of the middle with Daron Payne and Johnny Newton and now Kinlaw, and that's going to free him up for some one-on-ones, and we think this guy can take advantage. Sure, maybe. I don't know. I mean, Dorrance Armstrong's sack numbers last year were down relative to his years in Dallas. Do they think – but he also played very well, right, in some of the playoff runs. So do they think, hey, maybe we figure out some better ways to use Dorrance Armstrong. That'll get us going, perhaps. Obviously, Frankie Louvu is still a factor. And, you know, pass rush is obviously highly important for all aspects of the defense. But, you know, they did make moves towards the secondary to help there. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, again, I think the run defense part is probably what we're ignoring to an extent in terms of their liking of this. I imagine they're going to look at it and think Dietrich Wise is a better two-way player than the options that we had at that spot a year ago. Getting Javon Kinlaw clearly is a nod towards helping out on that run defense, being this elephant edge guy who's focused more on stopping the run than necessarily getting after the quarterback. So, yeah, I think they viewed these things as important. It's just that they didn't get, like, one guy. Right, Kinlaw was kind of like, really? Okay, that's interesting. Adam Peters knows this guy, but that was kind of out of the blue, especially for the contract, 3 years, $45 million. And they didn't draft somebody. So we're looking at it like, boy, they didn't get anybody that we would have figured. They obviously have a different view of it. So, yeah, I think they think it's a better group. And, again, against the run, I think it should be. But overall, we'll see. I mean, you still have to get Jalen Hurts and Dak Prescott off their spots, right? So, did they do enough of that? I don't know. We can make that claim. But, how many of us projected what was going to happen last year to happen? So, well, you know, you have to give them a little benefit of that, that they have a good feel. Like, you know, that's the thing last year, right? Other than Michael Davis, the cornerback, almost every single one of their free agent moves like worked out as well as you could probably hope, or at least pretty close.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe, you know, maybe they see something in some of these guys that we just haven't yet.
You wrote today about the undrafted free agent group that they're bringing in. Just kind of recap the, you know, 8, 9, 10 players that they've brought in. By sort of telling everybody who they clearly like the most based on the guarantees that they gave. I know that's not always a dead giveaway because sometimes it's the only way to get the player in because there's demand for that player. But who of the undrafted free agents have the best shot of making the team and who got the biggest guaranteed money?
Sure. And I know based on like comments I get or questions I get, people are really jacked for these undrafted guys or even the rookie camp invitation guys.
Yeah.
Slow the roll on that stuff. I mean, most of the time these things don't pan out at all. But look, there were guys like last year, Tyler Owens and Colson Yankoff made the roster. In years past, Cam Sims and Danny Johnson were undrafted free agents. And, you know, neither one was like a dynamo, but they both played several years for Washington in the league, and they were helpful at times. So, you know, we'll see. I think there, you mentioned – obviously, I use my guy Dane Brugler's guide because, you know, we're talking this level of player. Only a guy like crazy like Dane is going to know a lot about these guys. But Ja'Cory Brooks, the receiver from Louisville, I've mentioned, I think, maybe here before as well. You know, he's a really interesting one. The receivers are always the fun watches in camp because, you know, they can make these spectacular plays and we're watching the ball more than we're watching the line and things like that. And here's a guy who's sort of that classic version of that. 6'2", receiver, was a 5-star recruit to Alabama. You know, obviously Alabama has always had one of the deeper rosters. In the first 2 years, he was mainly a special teams guy, was thought to maybe was on the verge of a breakout as a junior year, but then he suffered a season-ending labrum tear. He did have a block punt in each of his first 3 seasons with Alabama. Then he transfers to Louisville, plays with Tyler Shuck, who obviously was a second-round pick with the Saints this year, and was a first-team All-ACC selection, over 1,000 yards, 9 touchdowns, primarily playing on the outside. You know, I think the fact that he has shown an aptitude on special teams, he can also return kicks and punts, is where I think that he's got an opportunity here because, again, if you look at that room, Terry McLaurin, Debo Samuel, Noah Brown, Michael Gallup, these guys are not typically playing on special teams. I mean, Debo did a little bit last year, but obviously, you know, that's not really what he's going to be looking to do. So, you know, that's a position, though, like where if you're going to have 6 players make the team, you're really going to have 4 guys that are not on special teams. That seems a bit much, perhaps. So maybe there's an opportunity for him to sneak in there. Likely he would be a practice squad guy, but I think he's a name to keep an eye on for sure. You mentioned some of the bonus money. Carlin Vigors, a defensive back.
Yeah, I've heard
Louisiana
a lot about him.
Monroe.
Yeah, tell everybody about Carlin Vigors, DB from Louisiana Monroe. They gave him some significant guaranteed money relative to the other undrafteds, right?
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America for America.
Optimize your nutrition this year with Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal service. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved, ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from 40 weekly options across 8 dietary preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Eat smarter at factormeals.com/listen50 and use code LISTEN50 for 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. Factormeals.com/listen50, code LISTEN50.
On my podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, we share the keys to succeed in business and in life. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, he got $259,000 guaranteed. Another cornerback, Fentrell Cypress out of Florida State, got about $145,000. What's interesting about both of these guys is, like, there's a, like, when I was looking at cornerbacks that Washington might take in the draft, guys, I was focusing on Siobhan Revell, the kid out of Florida State, the guy who played with Cypress down there, and Trey Amos. Were like, these guys were press corners, and this is a style that, you know, fits with what Washington wants to do. And Vigors has that sort of size dimension that makes a lot of sense. 6'1", 205. He's got that press corner style. He played extensively over 3 years in college. You know, not a ton of stats, and, you know, Louisiana Monroe is obviously, from a competition standpoint, far below the power conference school,
yeah,
and so on. But you know, they're taking a risk on, or they're taking a chance on the traits, and, you know, again, his size, his press coverage ability, this, and, you know, this is the type of player you want to take a shot on. And, you know, I think their cornerback group, and I would say the same thing with Cypress, a guy who also got good money, you know, as an undrafted guy. I will note that, you know, Dane Brugler, he looked at, I don't even know what the final number is, 2,000 players, something insane. But he only wrote like summaries on about like 400 of them. Brooks was one that got a write-up, and Cypress was another one. So I guess Dane has Cypress in his head ranked ahead of Vigors. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. But both those guys, like I said, in general, fit the same kind of size and style profile. And that's what you're looking to do. By the way, this is something I think is just so important. It isn't enough to just say, go get me talent. Go get a guy who makes sense. Like, what do we keep hearing this week about George Pickens getting traded? Well, he's not a Mike Tomlin kind of a guy. Well, they picked him. They took him in the second round. Are they just supposed to – is the GM not paying attention to what a supposed Mike Tomlin player is? I wrote last season that one of the big reasons why – this group had success was that Adam Peters didn't just arrogantly say, I think this guy is good, we're going to pick him and let the coach deal with it. He figured out, hey, Dan Quinn, hey, coaching staff, what are some of the things you're looking for? And then let me go out and find that guy. So, again, I don't know that either one of these Vigors or Cypress is going to factor in at all. Maybe they're practice squad guys, maybe not. But stylistically, they make sense for what is going on here. And that, to me, is as important as anything else, that they understand who they are, what they're trying to do, and find players that could fit, you know, say, because if they ever did have to play, you don't want somebody who is like a complete, it doesn't make any sense at all for what you're trying to do. So I think those guys, you know, again, a shot to make the 53 is special teams is going to have to be their hope, like it was with Owens and Yankoff. Yeah. But, you know, there's some optimism here in terms of the type of player these guys are.
We do this every year, okay, with, you know, people swearing on, you know, they watched Carlin Vigors and there's no chance he's not going to make the team. You know, I talked about just the, you know, the running back merit in the seventh round. One out of the last 33 running backs over the last 10 drafts drafted in the seventh round has made an impact in the NFL. and that's Isaiah Pacheco. So the odds are not stacked in his favor in terms of making a big impact. But yeah, it's sometimes you're talking about minutia, and I just asked you about the minutia. It doesn't really turn out to be much. But, you know, this they got to fill out the roster. You got to have 90 going to camp, and they have 90 now. I've got 3 minutes. I want to ask you about maybe another domino to fall, you know, whether it is Matthew Judon or Von Miller or Za'Darius Smith or a Nick Chubb. You texted me last week and you said, why are you talking about Nick Chubb? And I just said, because I like him a lot, and I think they should look at him just to check the health. Him and J.K. Dobbins are still sitting out there as free agents, and if they thought he was healthy, and Cleveland is not going to re-sign Chubb, you know, I would certainly take a look at it. So do you think that there's a chance that there's another big add before training camp? And if so, what's your hunch on who it would be?
Yeah, I would maybe say not necessarily before training camp, like maybe it's during, you know, once they get the guys out on the field. But, you know, maybe they make an assessment in minicamp or OTAs that, hey, you know, we kind of need more. But, you know, sometimes that big light bulb moment may not happen until they're really getting after it in camp. Yeah, but look, if you pointed to two positions, one would be the edge for the reasons that we just discussed. And, you know, there are some guys out there, you know, Jadeveon Clowney was just released by Carolina. You know, he's a known guy, of course.
No ties to Washington, though, right? I was going through the Clowney.
Yeah.
Am I right about that? Because I went through almost everything looking for any sort of relationship. I'm sure you did it, too.
Correct. I did. I did not notice anything of note. That does obviously seem to be a common factor with, you know, not just Washington, but a lot of teams. But, no, I didn't see anything obvious there. You know, look, I think all those potential guys, Za'Darius Smith, et cetera, Von Miller, like they're all basically, you know, the same type of profile. They're over 30, have had big success in the past with sacks and big plays. But, you know, we're now just rotational pieces. And, you know, look, are any of those guys better than, say, Cleveland Farrell? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, you know, you could make an argument in certain ways, but I don't know that the variance is that significant to where you would feel like you have to do something. You mentioned the Nick Chubb thing. You know, the running back room is still one where I was my take was they need to get speed on offense. I don't really care where it comes from, and obviously they went with the receiver. I still do wonder about the running back room to an extent, though. You know, one thing I've wanted to try to figure out that I haven't done as much as I haven't gotten as far as I would like is what happened to the running game last year? Was it because the offensive line was just really struggling to create opportunities? Clearly, they thought they needed an offensive line upgrade. Not that Laramie Tunsil is a run blocker, but whatever. He's obviously very good than they draft Connerly. But, you know, is Brian Robinson consistent enough? Can they rely on Austin Eckler to stay healthy, et cetera? I still wonder about that. Not that there's any really dynamic running backs out there. You mentioned Chubb, you know, maybe an extra year removed from his significant injury changes things, but, you know, there's just some guys out there. But I still wonder if that's a spot where maybe there's some change potentially happening or could happen. You know, I'm not saying it would, but like, and I wrote about this the other day. Somebody asked me in my mailbag about, are there players that you could see getting traded the way that Jahan Dotson and John Ridgeway were traded last year to recoup some picks? And, you know, I think Brian Robinson was a name that I mentioned because, again, it's not that it's necessarily likely or that, you know, that they have somebody who would be better than him. But what happened with that last year? Obviously, his numbers fell way off. He's not a guy that you could put out there all three downs. He's limited as a pass blocker. Yeah. Do they want somebody who's at least, even if it's not somebody who has his maybe upside between the tackles, somebody who's more consistent across the board, perhaps, and maybe one of those guys is Chubb or somebody else. So I think those are the two spots to me that if something is going to happen sooner than later or during camp would be the two areas to look at.
I agree. Have a good weekend. I'll talk to you.
Likewise, man. See ya.
Ben Standig, everybody. Up next, Sean McDonough will jump on with us. Of course, he is the lead hockey voice for ABC ESPN.
That's blocked by Martinuk. They didn't get it out. Carlson across for Ovechkin. Chikrin, the defenseman's at the net. Now Carlson scores! John Carlson! Wilson, a power play goal. As Wilson slides it through Chatfield, and John Carlson, the longest serving Capital, comes in on the back door.
First voice you heard is that of one of the best in the business, one of the best ever. Do it, Sean McDonough, last night in D.C. again with Ray Ferraro and Emily Kaplan on the call of Washington's 3-1 Game 2 win to even up the series. It resumes tomorrow night in Raleigh against Carolina. Sean McDonough, nice enough to join us right now. You know, I've had you on the show before, not that I'm asking you to remember it, but you've always been one of my favorites. I think you are just incredible at what you do. And before we get to last night's game and this series, I've thought about this as it relates to you over the years. I don't think anybody has ever done four sports at the level that you've done them at. Maybe there are some people that I'm forgetting. You know, I don't think Al did, you know, I don't think Michaels or Summerall did hockey. I don't think Costas did. I could be wrong. But am I right that in terms of doing football, basketball, baseball, and hockey at a very high level, that you are unique?
I guess, you know, I first of all, I really appreciate your kind comments, Kevin, and thanks for having me on. I guess, you know, I haven't really thought about it that much. I know some of the people you mentioned and some others who come to mind. You know, Marv Albert obviously did the Rangers for a long time, did NBC football, was best known for the basketball, but I don't think Marv ever did baseball.
Right.
You know, I can think of other people who probably did two or three at a national level, but I really don't know the answer to your question. You know, I just feel very fortunate because I love doing all the sports. It's really what I love about my situation at ESPN, the opportunity to do a lot of different things. And I get asked all the time, well, of all these sports you do, what's your favorite one? And I never have an answer because I really enjoy all of them. When I grew up knowing this is what I want to do for a living, you know, I was a all-around sports fan and kind of wanted to do exactly what I'm doing now.
Yeah, obviously with your father doing what he did for all those years. So how about not your favorite? Is there one that you think you do best?
I think if I had to say, I'd probably get the most positive feedback about college football. You know, the feedback about hockey tends to be I'm great or terrible and nobody seems to be in the middle.
Yeah.
That's not exactly true. That's an exaggeration, but you know, what I like most now about my situation is if you said what would be the two favorite things that you would do, I would say hockey and college football. And that's really exactly what I'm doing now. I'm doing the occasional other thing every now and then. I do a baseball game or a golf event. You know, I'm kind of disappointed that they moved the PGA Championship to May because, you know, I used to be able to do that in August with ESPN and our group, but now they've moved it to May. You know, it's in the middle of the hockey playoffs, so I don't get to do that anymore. But I really feel blessed because the two things I enjoy the most, the hockey and college football, are the things that I'm majoring in right now.
What do you think, for you, what's the hardest to do? What's the easiest to do?
I think hockey is the hardest, and in large part just because of the handicap, like last night there in Washington, of being really far away from the action. I mean, we're extremely high. I always tell friends of mine, you know, in most of these arenas, if you bought the worst seat, you know, it would be the last row of the upper deck. Well, go up there and then look further up and further away from the ice, and that's where we are. So
yeah, I know where that press box is. You know, that's way up there.
Yeah, it's way up there. And, you know, it's really hard to be sure exactly where the puck is. You know, a lot of times it's difficult to tell the players apart, you know, like with Washington, you know, 80 Dubois and 88 Mangiapane, it looks a lot alike from up above. 22 and 27 look alike. So, you know, there's a hesitation where in some of these places you have a low booth. You know, I was envious watching Bob Wischusen last night in Vegas. You're about 20 rows off the ice. You feel like you can reach out and touch the players, you know, you're that close. So you really know where the puck is and if the shot hit the goalie's pad or if it just completely missed the net or if it grazed the post, where, you know, most of these arenas were so high and so far away,
it's kind of an educated guess. And it really slows down your call. You know, when you're down low and you know what's happening, it just comes out much more crisply than it does. You know, I hate when I watch the tapes when we're really far away because there's just a slowness about the call that I wish wasn't there, but it's really a byproduct of just not being 100% sure all the time what's going on.
Well, do you, first of all, you said most places are really high up. So the Caps are not unique from that standpoint?
No. As a matter of fact, Carolina's worse. You know, Florida's really bad. Last year, and even this year, you may have noticed if you watched the game, we did a game at Florida in the Tampa Bay, Florida series, and ESPN, with the cooperation of the Panthers and the NHL, and we were there for the Stanley Cup final last year, they built us a lower booth, basically on a platform where they put some still photographers, and again, about 15 or 20 rows off the ice. And the difference is incredible, not just in, you know, how quickly you're able to identify everything and be sure of what you're seeing and what's actually happening, but the emotion of the crowd. You know, where we are, most of these places, you're really separated from the energy and the noise because you're just so far up in this sterile booth with a headset on. Where when we were down there, I mean, you know, when Ray Ferraro was speaking after a couple of Florida goals, I couldn't hear a word he was saying in my headset because it was just so loud. You're enveloped by the noise. So I would say 2/3 to 3/4 of the TV booths around the NHL are very high, and there are a handful of low ones. Edmonton is low. Dallas is kind of in the middle, but it's really good. Montreal's awesome. Pittsburgh's really good, New Jersey, but most of them are far away. And unfortunately, the two in this series are really far away.
Just out of curiosity, when you're in, and I know where that perch is, I mean, there's altitude. You almost need oxygen at Capital One where you sit and where the media sits. Do you call the action with binoculars, or do you sometimes go off the live feed in the monitor?
No, I don't do either one, you know, and I've tried both. It's just really hard to follow the puck for me through a pair of binoculars from that distance. And then you kind of get focused in too much on the puck, and you don't see things that would be out of the periphery of the binoculars, like, you know, the defenseman fell down or the goalie lost his stick or things like that. So I don't do that. I don't know. I've asked a lot of my colleagues, do you ever call it off the monitor? And I've never heard one person who says yes. Another part of that problem is the monitors aren't very big, so it's not much of a help. So it's just, you know, it's the nature of it. I just celebrate when we have a booth that's low. A part of me is cheering for that we'll have the Western Conference final if it's, you know, Edmonton or Vegas or Dallas or even Winnipeg, because all of those booths are low compared to the Eastern Conference final. All four of these are super high. Toronto is very high as well. As a matter of fact, when we did the All-Star game up in Toronto, I guess it was 2 years ago now, Burke Magnus, who's one of our bosses who basically runs now the production side of ESPN, came to the booth, and the first thing he said to me was, are all the booths this high? And I was like, no, but most of them, you know. And it was a good thing he came up there, because he was one of the people who signed off on us having the low booth for the Stanley Cup final last year in Florida, which was a huge difference maker.
We're talking to, of course, and you recognize the voice, Sean McDonough. You know, I mentioned, I think there's a uniqueness to the four sports that you've done at a very high level. I also think, and I've made this observation about you before as a fan on my show before, I think there's a uniqueness to your style from this perspective, and I'm wondering if you think it's fair. I think as a play-by-play guy, it's unique to inject opinion into the call, which I feel I get from you. Now, let me just say, I love it, and I think your opinions are super sharp in all of the sports that you do. I'm not an expert on hockey, so I have no idea if you're right or wrong. But do you feel that observation is fair, that maybe relative to other play-by-play guys, that you inject more opinion and analysis than a lot of other play-by-play guys do?
Yes, I do think it's fair, and I have always been that way, and I think it's a product. You mentioned my dad earlier. You know, I grew up the son of Will McDonough, who's a famous sports writer and the pioneer of the first newspaper man who made the transition into television as, you know, the what Adam Schefter does now. And you know, when we were kids, we'd sit and I had two brothers and, you know, we're all sports fans. My sister's sports fans too. And, yeah, we'd sit and watch games with my dad, and we wouldn't just stare blankly at the screen. I mean, he'd engage us in conversation about whatever it was, the officiating, the why do you think the coach went for that first down, or do you think he should have? So I think we were kind of taught to be analytical thinkers from an early age just by sitting there with him. And I've always said, Kevin, that I think our job, my job, is to be talking about what the people at home are thinking about when they watch the game. You know, if I'm sitting in the booth and I think, wow, that's a really bad call, then chances are most of the people who are watching the game are thinking that too. So that's something that we should be talking about. And I don't think, you know, opinion just needs to be the domain of the analyst. You know, I think we're around these sports all the time. Hopefully we're educated enough that we would have an educated opinion. So that's really what I try to do, just talk about what I think the people, if they were sitting on their couch watching the game with us, what they'd be saying to each other as they were watching the game.
Yeah, I look, as somebody who is not asked to report on anything but to opine on everything, I actually don't mind that, and I think you do it really well. You know, there's been some discussion, as I'm sure there is with everything that you do, from fan bases, and you mentioned that in hockey you get probably as much, you know, constructive critique as you do with anything. Do you feel that you've gotten that from Caps fans in these first two games?
You know, if I have, I don't know, because I don't do social media.
Okay.
I don't have a Twitter account, Instagram, any of that stuff. I never have. I don't even try to look into it. So the only time I'm really aware of the feedback is if I see an article. You know, somebody set me up with this Google search thing, so whenever my name appears in an article, I get a link to it through Google. So, you know, I see, and some of them, they aren't all just mainstream articles. Some of them are, you know, websites that I've never heard of, or you've never heard of, like most people.
Of course. Yeah, you can't. Right.
But what's interesting is they write articles based on five tweets from random people out there who may have six followers each, you know, and then it's people are outraged. Viewers are outraged that Sean McDonough's on this game, you know, and,
right.
And it's just funny because, you know, it's both ends of the spectrum. You know, the other night there was an article about the Colorado fans were upset that I was doing Game 7 because Bob Wischusen had done the series up till then. And then there was another article about Joe Buck had tweeted out that he was in awe of Kenny Albert and me and our talent because of the great job that we did in the Game 7s of the Dallas and Winnipeg series there on back-to-back nights. So that's more meaningful to me. You know, if six people sitting in their basement want to tweet out something that I'm not any good, they're entitled to that opinion, and I'm 100% fine with it. You know, I tend to pay more attention to the Joe Bucks and the Marv Alberts and Bob Costas and Mike Breen's and people like that who have sent me very nice texts about hockey over the years saying they really enjoy it, you know. So that's important to me. I care about what people are educated in the sport think, and
yeah.
The vast majority of the feedback that I've gotten within the sport has been extremely positive.
Well, as you should. And just to be completely open, I talked about this at the beginning because there was some, from Caps fans, some criticism that you were showing some sort of bias towards Carolina or anti to Washington. And I think that's a product of two things. One, we're just coming off the first round in which we get the hometown announcers. Now, Joe Beninati's as good as it gets. I'm sure you're very familiar with Joe and Craig Laughlin.
I've said that many times. I think...
Yeah,
somebody's
great.
Going to win the Foster Hewitt Award is, you know, and but going to the broadcaster's part of the Hockey Hall of Fame. He's great.
He's great.
And, so
and then, you know,
and so is Smoke and Al Koken and the rest of their group.
Al's great. Alan May, Craig Laughlin. It's a phenomenal, you know, team that's been together for years. But I think the other part of it is the Caps were dominated in game one. The score didn't reflect that. And then in the first period last night, it felt like an extension.
More of the same. You know, we were on for a lot of those Montreal games, and I think if they watched our telecast instead of Joe and Locker, and they made a good choice to watch Joe and Locker, you know, they wouldn't have felt like we were biased. You know, if anything, when the home team does well, and you're, you know, like you played the call of the John Carlson goal last night, I certainly yelled more loudly than I would have if the other team scored, because you're yelling over the home crowd. So,
yeah,
I also don't. It's another reason why I don't have social media, because I just don't pay any attention to that. I don't care who wins. I really don't. And I'd have no reason to be biased in favor of Carolina and against Washington. You know, I don't.
Especially since Carolina's positioning for you is even worse than Washington.
Yeah, it's even worse. All right. And, you know, and quite frankly, I mean, if you're going to say, well, what would you like to see going forward? You know, Carolina plays a style that doesn't always translate to very exciting TV. You know, they play that grinded out, low-scoring defensive game. It's not an up-and-down game, you know, as we've seen in these first two games. So, I mean, if anything, you know, you'd want the team that has a better chance to go up and down to be successful. But I honestly don't care, you know, and it's just, yeah, your hometown announcers are going to be more skewed toward your home team when you watch them, because that's what they should be doing.
So let's talk about the state of the series, because through the first period last night, I think there was a lot of concern and worry. What happened in the final two periods, and how does that sort of carry over to game three?
Yeah, I think the concern was justified. I was concerned for Washington, too. You know, we met with Spencer Carberry. We meet with both coaches before every game. And the first thing I said to him before last night's game was, well, how is this going to be different? You know, because if it's not different, the likelihood of them winning was pretty low. As you said, the score was close in game one, but if you watch the game, it really wasn't close territorially and that sort of thing. So, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, when he said, well, we can do basically what they did to us, which is get the puck in the offensive end and keep it in there. And it didn't, as you said, Kevin, it didn't start out that way. And then, you know, they kind of came around to it, especially in the second period. I mean, they had 11 shots on goal in the second period. They had 14 the entire first game. So, you know, they are capable of doing it. You know, they have guys who can go in on the forecheck and retrieve the puck and cause turnovers, and they did some of that last night. So I think it's a really even series. I think there are two teams that in many ways stylistically are similar. Both coaches have said that. And, you know, I think it's going to be a long series.
What do you think of this sport from this perspective? Because I do think you've got your observations are always keen and sharp, in that we could watch a game like Tuesday nights, in which I'm not a hockey guy, and I came in here and said I'm a sports fan. That was clearly a one-sided beatdown, and yet the score didn't reflect it. The Caps could have easily won that game. They were up 1-0 through, you know, half of the third period. What do you think about a sport which the results tend to be random, for the lack of a better description?
Yeah, I think that's sometimes the case. I mean, some teams that dominate the game win 6-1, too. So, you know, that happens. I think it's been a recurring theme with Carolina, right? This is the way they've played for 7 years now under Rod Brind'Amour. And I think he feels like they have to play that way, because they don't necessarily have, you know, the guys who are going to carry the puck through the other team. And a lot of teams don't have those guys, because there aren't that many of them. But he really believes this is the way they need to play offense. You know, get people in front of the net, get as many pucks toward the net as you can, and maybe you wind up like the winning goal in game one, Jacob Slavin. It wasn't pretty, but, you know, you keep throwing the puck at the net, and sooner or later some of those are going to go in. So, but you're right. You know, the premise of your question is spot on. You know, it can happen that one team seems to dominate territorially, piles up many more shots, but doesn't win. You know, it almost happened, as you said, in game one. And, you know, the other great equalizer in hockey is the goalie. I mean, you know, you could,
of course,
dominate. And Logan Thompson obviously played really well in both games. But, you know, one team could dominate territorially in the shot totals. But if the goalie plays great for the other team, that's the great equalizer. And it's part of what makes hockey great, in my opinion.
Why do you think, and we're sitting here at 1-1, but even going back to before game one, why do you think the Caps, who ended up with the best record in the Eastern Conference, the second best record in the sport during the regular season, are shorted so much by odds makers, by so-called experts? You know, they were an underdog going into this series. They're still an underdog in this series. They're the last odds favorite to win the cup out of the eight teams, you know, remaining. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. And I assume that's bet on, that's determined by people who actually bet on these things. I don't know. I mean, I think part of it might be that they didn't finish the season well. Maybe that turned some people sour on them. Yeah, I thought that was really understandable. You know, they had a variety of reasons why I think they weren't very good at the end of the year. I think the Ovechkin thing, you know, took a lot of the attention and maybe took something out of them a little bit, at least in terms of the focus. I think they had their playoff spot secured so early that, you know, there wasn't the motivation to keep driving because we need to make the playoffs or we need to make sure we're the number one seed. You know, I think the injury to Protas at the end of the year was key, and it's key to their chances now that he's back because he was one of the best players in the league this year and, you know, on any team. You know, when you talk about
right.
30 goals, 66 points, his size and speed, penalty killing ability, I mean, he was plus 40 in the regular season, which was third best in the league. He's a great player, and I give the Caps a lot of credit because, you know, they a lot of teams when they decide, well, we're going to turn over the roster a little bit, which they started to do a couple of years ago, you know, they tear it all down and then, you know, try to build it back up again, and that doesn't work. I mean, look at Chicago, look at Arizona, look at what San Jose is going through now. You know, it doesn't work, or if it does, it takes a really long time. They had faith, you know, Brian McClellan, Chris Patrick, the coaches, they had faith in guys like McMichael and Protas, who were first-round picks. These guys are going to develop, and they're going to score more, and they're going to give us more, and they did. And, you know, I think that's been a huge part of the success of their team, and then some of the other additions they made, bringing in guys like Matt Roy has been a nice addition, and some others. Obviously, the trade for Dubois worked out well. But, you know, to answer your question, I don't know the answer because when I look at their team, I think they're really solid in every area. I mean, we're seeing what Logan Thompson's capable of doing from a goaltending standpoint. He did it for most of the year. You know, they do have depths of scoring. I think unlike Carolina, which annually struggles with, you know, gosh, we just don't have enough guys we can depend on to get us a goal if we really need it, which is why I was surprised they flipped Rantanen into Dallas. You know, Washington does. You know, they have three lines, even four lines. I mean, when you look at what a guy like Duhaime's been doing on the fourth line, that can give you scoring, and the defense corps can give you scoring, as we saw last night from Carlson.
Yeah.
And Chychrun's, you know, one of the best defensemen in the league from that standpoint. So I don't understand it. You know, I think they're one of the best teams in the league. They were the number one seed in the East for a reason. I think they have as good a chance as anybody to win the Stanley Cup.
Last one, and I appreciate the time. You know, this era of Alex Ovechkin in this town has produced one cup and one deep run. That's it. You know, 2018. And then we had, you know, a memorable season with him chasing down Gretzky this year. Do you think that he and, you know, basically everybody by extension in the organization needs another deep run for, you know, a much stronger legacy than just the 1 year of playoff success?
I don't think he does. You know, to me, he cemented himself as one of the greatest goal scorers of all time. Maybe the greatest, obviously. You know, he got two Gretzky in the same number of games, which was remarkable, really. I mean, it was so amazing to me that it was literally the same number of games. You know, his place is secure forever. I mean, he's one of the great players of all time. And I, you know, what I admire more the last few years, and you know, we've been back in the NHL for 4 years now at ABC and ESPN, and you've done a bunch of Capitals games, and that he has done it while playing such a physical style, you know, being so eager to go hit people. And been as durable as he's been. I mean, he missed the 17 games this year, 16 of them because of the broken leg. I'm still mad at Spencer Carberry for taking him out on that Saturday afternoon a few weeks ago at the end of the regular season. We had a Saturday afternoon game of the week, you may remember, in Columbus. And, you know, he had just gotten the record. And really the reason we scheduled that game, our programming people did, was that
you thought it was going to be
it. Does it.
Yeah.
But so he didn't play. So I said to Spencer in our meeting before the game, I'm taking back my vote for the Jack Adams Award because I just voted for you. But now I'm not sure I'm going to if you're not going to have Ovechkin in our game on national TV today. But no, I don't think he needs it.
I really appreciate this. You're incredible at what you do. Keep it up. I think you're off Washington, Carolina. I think TNT's got the next few games, and then you're back on it towards the end of the series.
Yeah, we have a lot of NBA coming up. You know, we split the hockey and the NBA with TNT, so it's a nice partnership. They take over. We would be back if there's a game 6 and 7. in Carolina and Washington. And I think there will be at least a sixth, because I don't see anybody winning three games in a row here from this point
on. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate the time. Take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks.
Sean McDonough, everybody. There you go. On the call of games one and two. Yeah, the hockey arena setup for the announcers is usually not great. There's not a lot of room, you know, when it's played on ice and there aren't seats on the floor. All right, we are done for the day. I'll have my entire mock schedule out tomorrow on my podcast, and I'll bring a lot, all of it to the show on Monday. Again, I have them opening at Dallas on Sunday night, September 7th, and have them playing in Madrid. I had it before the leaks. On November 16th. Have a great weekend. Chris Russell's next.
Whoa, he has trouble with the snap, and the ball is free. It's picked up by Michigan State. Jalen Watts Jackson, and he scores on the last play of the game. Unbelievable.
All right, the Pablo Torre is reporting that Jordan Hudson is no longer allowed in the UNC football facility. UNC has come out to deny these reports and has said, quote, while Jordan Hudson is not an employee at the university or Carolina Athletics, she is welcome to the Carolina football facilities. Jordan will continue to manage all activities related to Coach Belichick's personal brand outside of his responsibilities for Carolina football and the university. Pablo Torre has responded in a tweet that is too long for me to read right now. The Washington Capitals get their lick back against Carolina to tie the series at 1-1. Connor McMichael opened the scoring, and Logan Thompson had 27 saves on 28 shots, posting a 9.64 save percentage. The Oilers take down the Golden Knights in overtime. Connor McDavid with a silky pass to Leon Draisaitl to ice the game. Oilers win 5-4. The Nats will take on the St. Louis Cardinals tonight. Mitchell Parker is expected on the bump, and the Nats on deck starts at 6:15 on 106.7 The Fan. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.